Roundheads and Cavaliers. This sermon is based on a book called The Return of the Prodigal Son by Henry Nouwen, which is a meditation about the parable of the prodigal son and the painting by Rembrandt, the late painting by Rembrandt of that parable in the Bible. I happened to watch a TV program called Roundheads and Cavaliers a few months ago. I think it was recently repeated. The theme of the program was how the 17th century religious conflict between an increasingly puritanical Protestantism and the old, more relaxed and worldly Catholicism became represented on the battlefields of the English Civil War in the armies of the two sides, and how that polarity between roundheads, the Puritan soldiers, and cavaliers, the king's soldiers tending to Catholicism, has endlessly been reenacted in British civil and political life. It quickly became clear that though the archetype is compelling, each generation rewrites its own version, with the relative proportion of roundhead and cavalier varying. So Puritan generals evolve into Tory squires, become Regency bucks, become Victorian aristocratic philanthropists, and the Bible-reading cobblers of the 16th century changed the wild ranters to the drunken London mob, to the honest trench fodder of the Great War, and to revolutionary hippies of the 60s. The confusion in all this was best summed up in the programme by Anne Widdecombe, who loudly protested her dislike of Oliver Cromwell and the Puritans, at the same time as complaining about the shops opening on Sunday, a thing, of course, the Puritans would never have allowed. Perhaps the standard textbook on British history, 1066 and all that, had it right when it summed up the whole thing by saying that the roundheads were right but repulsive and the cavaliers wrong but romantic. The programme was looking forward from the 16th century to today, but I did wonder that such a compelling myth of human society could have its origins less than 400 years ago. Was it not more likely that the archetype of conflict between moral rectitude and self-discipline on one side and a kind of extravagant, willful living for the moment on the other is one of the elemental stories of our species, which was just having a big moment during the English Civil War? It was the new vernacular Bibles of England and Europe that drove the Protestant Revolution. Even if you couldn't read, you could still hear the stories in a language you could understand. And they would have heard this myth again and again as they explored their new Bibles. Sometimes it was brothers or sisters, sometimes twins, sometimes colleagues or rivals. Cain and Abel, Jacob and Esau, Moses and Aaron, Saul and David, Leah and Rachel, Samson and Delilah. All these biblical characters in their complexity of character. And just as in our own time, the moral emphasis shifts subtly from celebrating morality and rectitude to celebrating originality and having a good time, these were the roundheads and cavaliers of the ancient Middle East. And then, here the myth is again in the New Testament, in the parable of the prodigal son, where St. Luke has Jesus use the story to show his listeners something of what values govern the kingdom of heaven, the character of God's love, or even what we're called to be like in the deepest and most profound part of our own nature. In Luke chapter 15, Jesus actually tells three parables to the moralistic Pharisees, the guardians of the Jewish law, who were disapproving of Jesus' tendency to mix with and teach those who they perceived as riffraff from the wrong side of the tracks. Jesus regards the Pharisees' legalistic hair-splitting and careful calibration of what was right and wrong as fundamentally opposed to the idea of the inclusivity and generosity of God's love. The first two parables, the lost sheep and the lost silver coin, make the case that in the political economy of the kingdom of heaven, no one is ever given up on, no one is ever written off. The Pharisaic view could be summed up in this way. Oh well, we've got 99 sheep safe, pretty good return seeing the number of wolves around this year. I think we'll leave it there. Or, the contract says that a 20% capital write-down is acceptable to our clients as long as they have access to immediate financial liquidity at all times. It's not worth wasting our time the whole day looking for that lost coin. Could be anywhere. According to Jesus, the divine spirit doesn't operate according to these calculations. The Hound of Heaven, as in the famous poem by Francis Thompson, never gives up on the chase, always comes back looking for you. You can never shake him off for long, just not ever. But in the third of the stories, the story of the prodigal son, Jesus tells a much more complex story, not so much a parable as a fairy story, and a very adult fairy story at that, with its conclusion left hanging in the air, pregnant with unresolved, messy human emotions. The situation described is not a simple domestic or commercial dilemma, as in the first two parables, but one of human pain and disillusion, of broken dreams and real mental suffering. When we start to think about the story, no longer are the listeners the Pharisees and the lowlife of first century Judea. It's actually you and me, 21st century Europeans. In this short story, the human emotions and drives are all there. I could put up a flip chart and we could list them, and then even act out the story ourselves and discover a few more. Anger, loss, fear, love, desire, ambition, lovelessness, forgiveness, envy, loneliness, self-pity. The list just goes on and on, all constellated around these two brothers, the wayward and self-centered younger son, our Cavalier, the moralistic and cautious older son, our Roundhead. When we consider these two and what they are feeling, we can begin to identify with some of the emotions they feel, or even with the characters themselves. Sometimes our lives have been governed by a sense of duty, which we bore resentfully, thinking of the fun everyone else seemed to be having. Sometimes we have followed some wrong or simply frivolous impulse because we wanted excitement or love, and ended up hurt or lost, or mixed up with people who were wrong for us, and far from the values we thought we believed in. Maybe those sibling archetypes were literally acted out in your own family. Were you an eldest, carrying the burden of your parents' expectations, or a younger one, allowed to get away with more in the shadow of your older brother or sister? Or even an older, only child, having to be both wild and dutiful, an adventurer, and the stay-at-home? Of course, in real life, parents are not even like this father. They're as willful and as resentful as the two brothers, critical, narrow-minded, judgmental, absent, selfish, even sometimes more immature than their children. The child doesn't only leave home because parental authority seems impossibly controlling and demanding. He or she leaves home because it really is those things. You only have to listen to the Beatles' She's Leaving Home to feel the desperate poignancy of all this. We could stop this address right now and you could spend the rest of the time talking to your neighbour about how all this has played out in your own life. Has one archetype dominated or has it changed as your life unfolded? Did you think of yourself in one way only to find yourself behaving in the opposite as you became involved with new friends or new situations? Roundhead or Cavalier? Elder or younger son? In his book, Henry Nguyen relates his fascination with Rembrandt's picture and how he had always identified with the younger son. As a young politicized Catholic priest, he traveled the countries of the world teaching and involving himself at the front line of radical Catholic engagement with injustice and oppression, never in one place long, far from home, ultimately almost having a breakdown from exhaustion. To his mind, he was a more socially engaged version of the younger son. Then, one time, A friend encountering the poster in Nguyen's office said, "You know, Henry, you're like the older son, really." For Henry Nguyen, it was one of those awful bombshell moments when you feel sick from realising you've got it all very wrong. He was forced to confront all his envy, his wearisome loyalty to his faith and position, all his craving for recognition and irritation when people didn't do what he wanted or expected, all hidden from him until that moment. So it is that we can see beneath this archetype of roundhead and cavalier something much more elemental. Whoever we think we are and appear to be, somewhere there's another side to us, different maybe, maybe opposite, sometimes described as the shadow. Not necessarily because it's bad, but because it lives in the shadow of our blindness and our fear. That wonderful glamorous pop star or comic genius turns out to be a tyrant and a bully. The moralistic preacher or politician railing against homosexuals cruises on the internet for casual contacts. Are they just being hypocrites? Or is it that in the success of their dominant character, in some kind of way, they can just ignore the other side as though it's not really there? And do we do the same in our own way? For Henry Nguyen, it was hard to be the elder son. He discovers this character is much more closely entwined with his role and self-image than he'd ever realised. He thought he was a kind of good version of the younger son, not indulging himself, but out there on the front line fighting for justice. But no, his shadow side, his older son, turned out to be a much better fit for who he really was. And this is doubly painful for him, for all of us who carry this disposition, because in the story, we are not told whether or not the older son will be able to respond to the father's entreaty to come and join the party. The younger son, in his utter humiliation and destitution, seems to find it easier to find the way back. But how much harder for the elder son to climb down from the tree of envy and hurt pride? Of course, the ending remains an unanswered question. How will the eldest son respond? Because Jesus is throwing down a challenge to the Pharisees, the quintessential elder sons. But this isn't to say there is no ending or resolution in this story. It's just that the ending is actually the same as the beginning. And that is the father's unquestioning generosity and acceptance toward his sons. Now, if I was preaching a strictly Christian sermon, I'd begin to tell you something about the unchanging nature of God, his forgiveness and mercy never faltering throughout all generations, a lofty vision of omniscient magnanimity before which we can only stand in awe. And it's true that such a vision may be enormously comforting. But even if I could relate to that, and I don't think I necessarily can, how could I possibly know, and even more, how would it help you? But Nguyen takes his vision of the Father's love in another direction, not the supremely lofty and powerful, but the supremely open and vulnerable. Nguyen points out that the father in the story goes out to both sons. He meets the younger son when he was still far off, and he leaves the party to entreat the elder to come in. He stands on no ceremony, cares not a jot for his own dignity. Indeed, it's very likely that in that culture, for the younger son to ask for his inheritance was tantamount to saying to his father, "I wish you were dead," a massive insult, as you can imagine. But the father's love for his sons is so great, it simply eclipses any criticism or judgment he might have. Their faults are manifest to us, but to the father they are nothing. He can hardly see them. Indeed, in Rembrandt's painting, the character of the father is painted as though he is an old blind man. This old man sees with the eyes of the heart, not with the calculating eyes of the world. This father's love is not so much perfect as naive, blind, trusting, accepting. You could even say it's foolish. But this is a love not unknown or beyond us. We may have experienced it in the first flush of a love affair, when our beloved could do no wrong, when even his or her faults seem like virtues, or perhaps the love of a mother for her newborn child, who sees nothing less than perfection in the baby. This love may seem all but impossible for us in all our disappointments, but it isn't abstract. We can imagine being less judgmental. We can imagine accepting others without criticism, discounting people's faults because who they are seems so lovely to us. It's called celebrating the glass half full rather than the glass half empty. In this understanding, divine love is not something beyond our understanding. It is actually something profoundly human, something we too can identify with in the deepest part of our heart. You don't even have to have any belief in God to say, yes, I can imagine my heart responding in this way if only the younger and the older son in me would only pipe down and grow up. This time of the year is wedding season, and if you've had the luck to have been invited to a church wedding, it's quite possible you've heard this love, this foolish love of the old father, just described to you by St. Paul in his famous passage from the first letter to the Corinthians. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It isn't rude. It's not self-seeking. It's not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. As I read this passage, I began to appreciate more clearly the words that come next, though not always included at weddings, and I hope you'll understand if today I substitute son for child and childish. When I was a son, I talked like a son, I thought like a son, I reasoned like a son. When I became a father, I put the ways of a son behind me. Now we see but a poor reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. Has ever the goal of all spiritual paths been better described than in those last verses? To grow beyond the delusions of this world and experience reality face to face. To be conjoined in a deep knowing in which our human frailty is held and expressed and understood and ultimately healed. This way of healing, this way of the spirit, doesn't require us to be anything different, a younger son or daughter, an older son or daughter, whatever. We can't by sheer mental effort or repression banish them or pretend to be anything other than we are anyway. But this story of the prodigal son suggests that if we allow ourselves to grow into the father or the mother as well, this internal loving parent who keeps no record of wrongs will see us completely differently. What we are is actually okay. Is actually beloved. And as we allow that kind, accepting, loving part of us to grow, slowly, slowly, the hurt and sad person we so often are can become slowly changed. It may take a lifetime, or who knows, many lifetimes, but we will in the end reach that place where we are fully and deeply known and understood. And the wounded child in all of us will have finally grown up. You may have noticed that there was a little bit missing from the end of that quotation from St. Paul's letter to the Corinthians. Well, here is that famous last verse to finish this address with. And now these three remain: faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love.